Hello, I'm Ross Kamich, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science across the full spectrum of life's experiences. And I am so excited to have my guest today because I think when I started this podcast, I always had this guy at the back of my mind. And so without further ado, my guest is Dr. Jeff Oxnard. Jeff, would you care to introduce yourself in any way you see fit?
Hi, Ross. It is so nice to be here with you. Thank you for the invitation. I'm Jeff. I'm a lung cancer doc. I'm calling in here from Boston Medical Center, where I still have a little clinic Friday mornings. I'm a dad of four and an enthusiastic family man. And I'm a cancer researcher. And I have had the joy of a cancer research journey that has gone through multiple phases, which I look forward to sharing with you and in the audience on this podcast.
So what is your official, I mean, I love that, but, and you're kind of ignoring the elephant in the room. You have an official job, actually, separate from those other jobs.
Yeah, I'm the chief medical officer at Blossom Hill Therapeutics. And so earlier this year, I joined a small biotech startup that is developing super interesting and creative precision medicines. And so, yeah, my job is to bring these drugs to life and craft a plan to get them FDA approved and making an impact for patients.
As our listeners will hear, I would say Jeff is one of the most energetic people I've ever known. And it's an energy that he shares. And it's really been exciting to watch you sort of grow into the leader that you are now. But anyway, let's go back in the time machine. Where did the young Jeff Oxnard, you know, where was he born and brought up?
I grew up in New Hampshire, about an hour north of Boston, on a little horse farm. My parents were small-town pediatricians. I'm one of four kids. We grew up splitting wood. I love splitting wood. It's probably my only exercise, Ross. We grew up driving the tractor and shoveling manure and going to the local public school. My mom was on the school board. And I was a kind of nerdy kid who went home and did farm chores on the weekends.
And there was, I mean, both parents were doctors. And I think you told me your granddad was a fairly accomplished physician too.
Yeah, actually three of my four grandparents were doctors. My dad's dad was a small town family doc who, you know, did house calls. My mom's mother was one of the early female physicians trained at Hopkins. She ended up working at a prison. She did prison medicine for a period. And then my mom's dad, Evan Calkins, was an academic. He was at MGH for a while and set off and was chair of medicine at the University of Buffalo. And he certainly was one of my role models as I think in my youth struggled, do I want to grow up to be a doctor? And then when I finally settled into owning it, he was a academic physician researcher who I aspire to grow up and be someday.
You said you were one of four. Where are you in the lineup?
I have one older, one younger, and twin.
You're a twin?
I'm a fraternal twin. My twin is also a science enthusiast, though a little bit different than me. All of us were smart kids of sorts, I guess. If you describe the Oxnard energy, we're all generally energetic, smiley, chipper kids.
Gosh, that sounds exhausting. I feel sorry for your parents.
My parents similarly are energetic folks who still live on this small farm in New Hampshire as they approach 80 and still look after the place. It's a vigorous place to spend the weekend.
I can imagine. So out of the four siblings, how many went into medicine?
How about this? Of the 30 cousins I have on my mom's side, under these two physician grandparents, really only a handful of us have become doctors. There's another one, a few years younger than me, and another one a few years younger than that. But I would say there's lots of different things that a smart, sciencey type can go do. Even I, you know, in my college period, you know, I wasn't sure that medicine was for me, even though I enjoyed the mixture of scienceiness and communication. You know, I'm a communicator, Ross, right? And I think these two things kind of mix together nicely in medicine. I took a couple years to go test out if this was really for me. I was actually in a fellowship in England for a year in Shrewsbury, teaching high school.
When did you do that?
This is after college, the year after college. I was a fellow at Shrewsbury School.
Wow.
you know, and the American fellow is there to be sort of cheerful and smiley and go running and act like an American, I think. And I got to teach chemistry and teach a little politics and teach sex ed. It was fun. I enjoyed teaching, but I think then I decided I was committing to being a doctor. I did a year working in marketing in LA at Princess Cruises. I tried different things until I finally owned the fact that I decided I was destined for medical school. And when I ended up at University of Chicago, it was perfect. I loved it. And I'm so glad I took that path.
So your undergraduate degree was Harvard, majoring in chemistry. And then how much time kind of, you know, self-analysis was going on? 2 years, you say?
Two years deciding that I wanted to be a doctor. And then I dove in.
And then why Chicago?
Good school. You know, I'm not going to say that I was a perfect med school candidate. I got on off the wait list. So it's not like I had my pick. A very sciencey curriculum that allowed you to dive in deeply. I really enjoyed the richness of material. You know, the chemistry wasn't as much for me by the time I got to medical school, but embryology, the anatomy. I loved the visual components of anatomy and embryology. For a while, I thought it might want to be a radiologist. Until finally I met Nick Vogelzang, who was the oncologist who I shadowed in clinic. And I was like, oh, I want to be that guy. Like, I want to grow up to have these meaningful conversations in clinic with patients. The vividness of being an oncologist is unmatched. And that's when I decided that was the path for me.
And Vogelzang, he was at Chicago at the time?
Yeah, he ran the cancer center at Chicago, and he studied, he was a geo-oncologist, but also studied mesothelioma. And so I fell in with the mesothelioma research program. I did mesothelioma imaging research. I sort of was in a radiology lab and doing some oncology work. And that's when I started saying this research stuff is fun. And I enjoyed the creativity and I enjoyed the communicate, right? It's not enough to just have a neat idea, but telling the story of why this science matters to people, I found very satisfying as well.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that's some of the things I've really enjoyed about you, both your ability to get enthused about research to an academic audience or to a patient audience. And I've seen your talks to patients about, what do we talk about, the three rules of Oxnard or something, like when you're dying.
Three rules of living with lung cancer, yes.
Remind us what they are. They were awesome.
Yeah, well, we're fast-forwarding a little bit right now. This is...
No, we'll fill in. Don't worry.
Okay, sure. But I think all of us as oncologists have to figure out our rhythm, our system of how we, stay fresh and deliver high-quality care for every patient we meet. I remember a patient coming to see me and after the end of an hour saying, this has been amazing. Quick question. My daughter's engaged to get married in a couple of years. What do you think about wedding dates? And I was like, I love that I'm a participant after an hour of knowing this woman in the wedding dates of her kids, right? And that's the vividness of oncology. The three rules that I have cultivated and I share with a lot of my patients, which is really meant to be liberalizing and motivating, is one, when you're living with lung cancer, don't act sick. You know, get dressed every day and go do stuff. There's nothing specific you have to do. It's like, well, should I go running? And I'm like, well, don't act sick. Should I spend time with my grandkids? Well, don't act sick. Just find whatever that is for you and go do it so you can maintain your performance status. Two is don't lose weight. And they say, should I eat avocados? And I say, don't lose weight. Should I eat sugar? Well, don't lose weight. Like whatever appetite helps you feel vigorous and keep on a few pounds for a rainy day, please, don't lose weight. And rule number three is don't be a tough guy, which is, for a long part of our life, we avoid doctors. Then at a certain point, illness is ours and we have to own it. And that involves speaking up about your symptoms, telling your doc what's going on, being willing to complain, and through them telling us how they're doing, we can treat their symptoms.
I think your other way is like, if you have painkillers, take your painkillers. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't be stoic. Don't be a tough guy. Right. Don't act sick. Don't lose weight. Don't be a tough guy.
All right. So let's fill in some gaps. Okay. So you go to Chicago, you go to medical school, you encounter Nick Vogelzang and you start to go oncology, that might be interesting. And then back to Harvard, right?
Yeah, Nick Vogelzang and Hedy Kindler, also a mentor of mine while I was there. I did some research. I enjoyed research. And then I matched in residency at Mass General Hospital, where my grandfather had been faculty many years back. And that felt very special. So I was there for 3 years and really enjoyed learning to be a doctor. And that's when I encountered EGFR for the first time.
Yeah.
And hearing about EGFR mutations from Tom Lynch and Lisha Sequist, and that sounded just like a magical whole new world of science and oncology. Still was not really a reality yet, but the trickles of it was just beginning.
The idea that certain patients had a specific change in the DNA of their tumor, which made them susceptible in a good way to a targeted drug called an EGFR inhibitor, epidermal growth factor receptor inhibitor. I'm just translating for the audience who can't keep up.
Yeah, thank you. And Levi Garraway was there and designing new molecular testing approaches. It was all very exciting. I knew just enough as a medical resident to be dangerous, but enough that when I applied to fellowship and I matched at Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York, I got into Vince Miller's clinic. And Vince Miller was my mentor in fellowship. Vince Miller was on faculty there and did a lot of that early work in EGFR and KRAS. And then he left to be chief medical officer at Foundation Medicine.
Explain what Foundation Medicine was then.
Because Vince was
like the first big name academic to go there.
Yeah. Vince was the original, medical researcher to join. It was founded by a bunch of Harvard genomics types. Foundation basically figured out how to take a piece of formalin fixed tumor and get great DNA out of it. So to provide next generation sequencing. And so the widespread NGS that we do for cancer patients to characterize their tumor, there were early insights in how to do that on factory scale at Foundation Medicine. And so that was a company founded by a bunch of Broad researchers to try to make this technology that was previously kind of done in certain academic labs widely available for cancer patients anywhere. I remember Vince's clinic, he would look through the panel of patients and say, look at what a day we have ahead of us. EGFR, ALK, KRAS, EGFR, ALK, EGFR. That clinic was a creative time to think together about the biology of cancer and what's going well and what's not going well and how to think about how to treat it better. I really enjoyed using clinic as a time for ideating and brainstorming about how can we do a better job for these patients. And Vince cultivated that in me.
And I have to go back to the horse manure story at some point, but that can come in later. Hold on. So why Harvard to New York? I on the map, they look pretty close, but is Boston to New York? Is that a commute or did you physically move?
We don't always pick our destinies, and that's where my destiny took me. I think that I saw the opportunity to learn more about doing great cancer research at MSK, but I'll admit the path pulled me back to Boston. In fact, shortly after I matched in New York, I met my future wife in Boston, and I was like, well, this is inconvenient. And so then, yes, after 2.5 years in New York of learning about genomics and doing research and really enjoying drug development and applying precision molecular testing to drug development, I moved back to New York to be with my wife, who was based there. She was in medical school at Harvard, and I got a faculty role at Dana-Farber. And so I am a New Englander fundamentally, and that's where I've been ever since I got back to Dana-Farber.
What was it like in New York, for the farm boy? The very academic smart farm boy, but the farm boy.
Well, it's broadly. I've lived in L.A. I lived in Chicago. I lived in New York. I think we should learn the world, right? I think the richness of opportunity at Memorial Sloan Kettering was amazing, and I thought there were fascinating diversity of patients I saw. I still kept the farm feel alive in one subtle way. I don't know if I told you this, Ross. I would collect my compost and pack it up in a sealed bag in the freezer and drop it off every week at the compost collection. That's the way I kept that farm feel alive while I was living in Manhattan.
I love it. I love it.
But it was a great place for a few years. There's a lot of good places to live. But yeah, my roots are in New England. My family's still here. And so in terms of a place to settle down, this is where I want to make my roots.
Okay. I brought it up, but I want to come back to the manure. Didn't you tell me that when you got into medical school, your letter was about shoveling manure or something?
No, this is as a small town boy from New Hampshire, my college admissions essay helped me get into Harvard was about shoveling manure, about the hard work of turning a manure pile into the satisfying feeling of a job well done. And I used, the process of shoveling manure around the farm as an allegory for the satisfying feeling of hard work accomplished.
It must have been an amazing essay, because on the surface, it doesn't sound like it would win you anything.
Well, it was a while ago, but I will say that, you know, I've told you I'm a communicator. I'm a big believer in writing and the joy of putting words to pen. When I left fellowship, Mark Chris, who ran the Thoracic Group, gave us all a book, Strunkenwhites, Element of Style. And it was to say, look, never stop writing. In the end, we, you know, as academic scientists, it's not about having great ideas. It's about putting those down onto paper to apply for a grant to, you know, generate attention for your research through manuscript writing. I remember writing a letter to one of my high school teachers, my high school English teacher, Miss Wheeler-Smith, who really inspired the joy of writing. And so I do think we as scientists and as physician scientists also need to be writers and communicators.
We do, because otherwise no one cares what we're doing. We're just weirdos who just sort of work in a lab, you know.
Or what's worse, they misunderstand what we're doing, right? And they think it's somehow peculiar or quirky or not related to them. And so only through communicating can we make the point of why this is important, not only for our research ecosystem, but for oncology more broadly.
So you started back at the Farber in the Harvard system in Boston in what year?
2011.
Okay. And that was the beginning of the Dr. Oxnard as we and the rest of the world started to appreciate.
Sure.
And did you know, when you went into that job, did you know what tumor type you were specializing in at that point?
There was some flexibility. You know, that's the flexibility of academia, I think. Bruce Johnson ran the group, and he brought me on as an energetic young researcher saying, yeah, go to it, Jeff. And what I'd done so far is I'd studied EGFR, I'd studied resistance and T790M. I had a research project studying familial EGFR mutations that actually was birthed back in my days at Memorial Sloan Kettering that I brought with me. And I launched a program studying germline EGFR mutations.
Okay, let's try and explain what that means.
Well, most of the DNA mutations we as lung cancer doctors study are DNA changes in the tumor. We sequence the tumor to understand what makes this tumor think and what is its biology and what vulnerabilities might this tumor have that I can understand by sequencing it, by finding a change in EGFR or ALK or ROS. But we also have our own familial genes. And we as lung cancer docs don't think as often about changes in your inherited genetics. But nonetheless, we got to figure out what is it that causes lung cancer to happen. And in my early work at Memorial, I met a patient I remember now still who had an inherited EGFR mutation and had a family that kept developing EGFR mutant lung cancer. And that sort of birthed in me a curiosity about this rare syndrome. And so I launched a remote participation study, which over many, many years, Ross, enrolled dozens and in the end over 100 patients to get testing for this rare inherited syndrome and understand what is this rare type of familial lung cancer and how can it help us think about why it is that folks get lung cancer in the beginning.
And so, I mean, first of all, the idea of a remote study then was just groundbreaking. The idea that you don't need to come see me in Boston, you know, here's in the blood sample. You know, it's cool. Tell me some facts and send me a blood sample.
Yeah, I remember back then I asked Dana-Farber, I was like, so can I get a website for my research? And they're like, I guess that's weird. Sure. If you ask for a website for your research today, it's very protected, right? But back then they're like, okay. And so patients all around the U.S. would sign up and say, I want to learn more. And I'd say, okay, great. Well, here's the study. And that's...
Was it a blood sample or like a sputum sample? What did they say?
It was a buccal swab was fine, or a blood sample if they wanted. But this was a syndrome that people didn't really think existed. But patients were out there with it and they were saying, how do I learn more? Ross, strangely enough, I had just met a patient in my own clinic here in Boston with a germline EGFR mutation sitting in front of me. And I said, I think I know what's going on here. And so like these people are out around the U.S. It happens to be an extremely rare and mostly U.S. only phenomenon, this syndrome. But it does, you know, I'm interested in it because there's been a narrative about lung cancer over the decades, and we understand that narrative. It's an environmental disease caused by inhaled exposures, et cetera. But that narrative is shifting really during the period when you and I, our young investigators, characterizing this shift. And what can change perspectives about lung cancer more than thinking about rare families that get lung cancer through an inherited genetic change and no other environmental exposure at all. And so I feel like, you know, zooming in on outliers like that and bringing them to life can really help us change how we think about a disease like this.
So two things. So one is we need to explain that this is not exactly the same mutation that drives an established lung cancer. Otherwise, the person wouldn't be a human. They'd be a big ball of cancerous cells. So,
right. Yeah, this is
explain. This is saying what exactly is inherited here.
Yeah, the genetic change that we will work that you can find in 1 in 1,000 lung cancers, let's say, is a mutation called T790M. It's a resistance mutation that I studied early in my career. T790M, on its own, isn't oncogenic enough to cause a cell to become cancerous. You can live with T790M, but for some reason, your lung cells are then more willing to develop a second mutation. And that co-mutation, an LA58R mutation, will lead to growth. And so in these families and individuals, they can have lung nodules in their lungs for many, many years. And eventually one of these lung nodules can become a real cancer and they can be treated with these new therapies, EGFR inhibitors. And so, I mean, I've met, you know, a young man in his 40s whose brother just died of lung cancer, but never got molecular testing.
Yeah.
But we know what kind of lung cancer his brother got because this family gets a certain kind of lung cancer, EGFR mutant lung cancer. So I think it's empowering to tell individuals that this is a risk factor they live with because, one, it says you better get a CAT scan because you might be at risk of lung cancer, whether or not you ever smoked. And two, the kind of lung cancer you get can be very treatable with a pill. And therefore, it can be very empowering to know what kind of therapies you should try to go get.
I mean, it's funny when you tell the story of just having found a patient in your own clinic with this, there is that or excitement, which is almost nothing else equals it, where you know that you are the world expert and you're sitting in the same room with this person with something that you've discovered. And it's kind of like, what a privilege to be able to be in that position.
What a privilege to still be able to see patients, Ross. Even as I focus now on drug development, it is very precious to be able to spend time here at BMC. But, you know, you have that same feeling because you're curious. And when you find, you know, a Ross rearrangement, you say, I know this, and it's sitting right here in my clinic, right? But that's because we're curious enough to test. I like to tell audiences, what's more common, ROS-positive lung cancer or mesothelioma? And if I ask the audience, have you ever seen mesothelioma, all of their hands go up. And I say, have you ever seen ROS-positive lung cancer? Like a couple people say yes, but they have the same prevalence. It's just, you know meso when you see it, but you don't know ROS-positive lung cancer unless you're curious enough to test for it. So I think there's all sorts of interesting diversity of cancer all around us. And we just need to be curious enough to test every patient. And in doing so, reveal the opportunity, the therapeutic opportunity that's sitting right in front of us.
It's funny you should say that. I remember talking to a very senior academic in a different institution who shall remain nameless. And they were explaining that they only did molecular testing on people with a certain histology, a certain appearance of the lung cancer under the microscope, because the frequency of these other things and other histologies was too low to bother. It always reminded me of the supermodels who don't get out of bed for less than $1 million. And so, you know, the frequency of, in this case, EGFR mutations in something called squamous lung cancer was quoted as 2%. And they said that's too low to bother. And you go, well, what's the frequency of ROS1 rearrangements? 2%. And you go, what?
Yeah.
You test for guzzles.
Yeah. I just treated a squamous lung cancer, 100-pack year smoking history, EGFR mutation. And I showed it to my colleague. And my colleague was like, but I thought you're not supposed to test them. And I was like, but I did. Watch me. You know? And I changed the course of that patient's disease through my curiosity. And so, yes, let's just be broad in our curiosity and we'll create more treatment opportunities.
I mean, I get it. When the technology first came, this is going to get into foundation in a second, but when the technology first came in, it was so esoteric, so expensive, that there was an element of rationing who should do the testing in. But as like the cost of microchips, you know, has come down with volume, the idea that, you know, we as paternalistic doctors should say, I'm not going to bother testing you because the frequency is too low for me to care. And you go, well, what if you're that one?
So which leads to what are the barriers, right? And it might be a barrier of creativity. It might be a barrier of just being curious enough. But there are also operational logistical impediments. And if we can eliminate those, then we can make it widely available. So we're going to quickly do my almost 10 years at Dana-Farber, which was researching, you know, resistance and rare genotypes and ways of testing patients and studying liquid biopsy, this way of getting at genetic changes through simple blood testing, and all this super fun creative research. And at the end of about 9 years, my 99-year-old grandfather finally passed. And I said to myself, maybe I can change my direction now. And maybe it's okay if I shift things up a bit. And I got curious about a different kind of science, applied science, working on the industry side to make a difference rather than academic creative science. And so that's when I took a role at Foundation Medicine. And we can zoom in on that more, but I think back to what you were just saying, the opportunity working at a company like Foundation Medicine, developing FDA-approved liquid biopsies, is to make testing so accessible, like easy to test and reimbursable, that there's no excuse that you don't test that lung cancer patient in front of you. I remember when a colleague said to me at Dana-Farber, they knew I was an enthusiast about liquid biopsy. He said, I've started ordering liquid biopsies, Jeff, and I can't stop. A test that is so satisfying to order that there's no reason you wouldn't do it. And you can't wait to order it again, because who knows, it might give you a result a week from now that changes the story of that patient in front of you. And so, yes, that's why I went to Foundation, a chance to change the ecosystem from a different side of the table.
Okay, so we are going to drill down into that, because obviously there's both push and pull in a major life decision. So at this point in time, like nearly, you know, 9-10 years in the Harvard system, you're married. Do you have kids at that point in time?
Married and kids, living in the suburbs, yeah.
How many kids have you got?
I have 4 kids now.
Okay. How many do you have at that point?
I think we had 3. Maybe we were pregnant when we were born.
Okay, your grandfather died, the one who was the professor in Buffalo.
Yeah.
Was that kind of like, you know, granddad's not looking, I can now do what I really want? I mean,
he actually always said to me, there's a time when you're like, need to just set off and do your own thing. And for him, that was, you know, he had something like 8 kids outside Boston and was at MGH.
It's a very fertile family you come from.
Yeah, I cover, right, 30 cousins, right? And he said, you know what, I decided I need to set off and do my own thing. And so he went to Buffalo and was chair of medicine. He really was very fond of that, you know, making his own path. For me, I'm pretty wedded to Boston. And I, again, incredibly blessed to have a rich experience in academia. But I guess I thought about his lesson to set off and say, what would that look like for me? I'm not going to Buffalo. It just doesn't fit, you know, me at this point in my life. But maybe setting off for industry would be a way of trying something new, learning a new way and making a different kind of impact.
Well, so there were two things when we chatted before. So one was you didn't do the industry path to the pharmaceutical industry. You went to a diagnostic company. So was that just because Foundation Medicine was in Boston? But there's lots of pharma companies in Boston, so it can't just have been that.
You and I both get to work with so many pharma companies over our academic period, advising and thinking creatively. And that's very fun. It's fun to influence the ecosystem from the side as an academic. It occurred to me maybe at Foundation Medicine, I can influence this world of precision medicine from an impactful company that's well-established and knows what they're doing, but then collaborating broadly with different pharma companies developing precision medicine. And so I can help to catalyze the use of genomics to develop new cancer therapies. So I thought it was an interesting way that I could still influence drug development and influence patient care all in one place. I didn't have to sort of pick a side in one drug. I could try to support lots of different therapies. And I found that really rewarding, a really neat way of learning about the ecosystem and how to accelerate adoption and development of precision cancer therapies.
And then the other thing, when we talked before, as I said, there's always push and pull. You'd made some comment about careerism. Do you remember that? And you have to explain what you mean by it.
Yeah, sure. I had this moment when I started feeling like the thing I was developing wasn't just the science, but I was actually developing my own CV. I found that I would do things because one of the things we need to do in academia is have a longer resume. And I'm not saying most of what we do. No, mostly we see patients and mostly we do all sorts of great research and all sorts of creativity. But there are some things you end up doing because you're supposed to do them. You do them because it's going to be good for your career. And I, you know, what it leads to is a lot of saying yes to stuff, a lot of overcommitting, maybe a little bit of feeling like you might be missing out on the next big thing for your career. And then I wasn't sure, you know, I think there was some great paper I wrote and I said, oh, that's a great paper, but so what? Like, what happens next? How am I going to get people to run with it? And as much as I tried to get off an industry to run with this idea, I couldn't get someone to take it to the next level. And so, yeah, in industry, we still do science. I still do trials. I still develop therapies the way I did as an academic drug developer in many ways. But the output, the result is not the science in and of itself, but the science has to get to FDA approval and impact and adoption. So it's a lot of the same science, but with a different vision of what success looks like.
Got it. So when you first moved to Foundation, were you clear in your head what you were going to do there? I mean, I know what you ended up becoming, but what was it like when you first arrived? Hi, I'm Jeff, you know.
Clinical development, which is what many academic positions do when they go into industry, is doing science for the sake of getting a product to impact. And that's either developing products before they're on the market, in which case what you're doing is you're developing an evidence base that allows a drug to get approved, for example, or a device to get approved, or a device to get launched. Or for products that are on the market, you're developing evidence that allows people to use them better and figure out how to use them. And so, you know, a lot of the output in my early time at Foundation Medicine was the same kind of output that you or I would do in academia, which was, well, I'm going to write a paper and that paper is going to tell a story about how to use liquid biopsies really well, right? Only at Dana-Farber, I had access to a handful of patients that were in my clinic. And at Foundation Medicine, I had access to thousands of data points, you know, across a much broader data set. So I think many of the outputs are the same. If there's a difference, Ross, it's that I sometimes find in academia, I would be pursuing the most glorious journal. I would say, oh, I got to get this into a great journal, right? Because that's going to be good for the program. It's going to be good for awareness. Everyone's going to know about this important science if I can get it just into this journal. But in industry, there's a different sense of urgency. It's like, how can I get this out into people's hands as soon as possible? And sometimes that doesn't mean, you know, rostering your way through a couple of journals. It means just like picking a journal and getting it published. And so, you know, the output is often science. But I think the output, the urgency of the output is different in industry. And also the, in academia, if what you find isn't real, if the paper in the end was false discovery, well, maybe the idea didn't pan out, which it was just an idea. The stakes aren't that high. It's like, you know, it was creative science, right? Maybe it worked, maybe it didn't, but we gave it a good shot. In industry, if you have a scientific output that is not fully validated and the real thing, you know, company goes bankrupt, everyone loses their jobs, right? So there's a commitment to exquisite rigor in industry that maybe sometimes is overblown, maybe sometimes slows down science, but is because of the urgency that this data go the distance and help get a product to get approved and on the market.
So looking at your resume now, which fortunately is much, much thinner than an academic resume. You're kind of like, I did a whole bunch of stuff and I was incredibly famous, but that's like one sentence now. You managed to disengage yourself from patients for what, 9 months before you found your Boston Safety Net clinic? And so talk me through that process. Was that always at the back of your mind? Was it, did you notice a sort of homesickness for actually being a hands-on clinician?
My plan had always been to maintain a clinic. Foundation Medicine said, great, you know, keep your clinic. When I took their development role at Lilly, they said, oh, terrific. Yes, keep seeing patients. You know, what an opportunity for insight. And so, yeah, that's always been part of me. It's something that not everyone who works in the industry gets to maintain, and I'm glad I've gotten to. The catch is the conflicts of interest. And so because of those conflicts, it was, I didn't find it feasible to keep working at a Harvard hospital. But Matt Kalki runs the oncology group here at Boston Medical Center. And he said, yeah, we'd love to have enthusiastic physician like yourself, Joe. Just, you know, be forthright about your conflicts of interest, and it's worked out.
I don't do research here at BMC. I don't enroll in trials. I see patients, and I'm a great team player. I love being at the tumor board, but I keep at arm's length from active research because of those potential conflicts.
So just describe what Boston Medical Center is.
Boston Medical Center is the historic city hospital in Boston. So it's a safety net hospital. It provides for a very diverse and very needy cancer population. I would say most of my patients don't speak English, but plenty of them do. I see patients of a wide diversity of ancestries that come from all over the world. And many of them are immigrants here to Boston. Others are not. And they're very needy. That's a different environment than treating patients at Dana-Farber. And I feel privileged to be a part of their care.
Did you have to? I had a friend who had gone from academia and then to work off her J-1 visa, had to work in a safety net hospital like 4 days a week and then could have one day a week with us. And it was, she described how difficult it was to sort of change gear from like, you know, high gear down into low gear because it was the art of the possible. It was like, I know this is what I would love to do, but this is what I can do.
I think it's pretty cool how great cancer care can be done in a lot of environments, right? And so, yeah, I'm not enrolling to the craziest new therapy. I miss that, right? I mean, it's really exciting to be using brand new therapies. But even when you're not enrolling to trials, there are brand new therapies coming out all the time, right? And I remember when I one of my early clinics, one of my colleagues said, oh, would love your advice on this. I have a patient with an EGFR mutation who developed resistance and now has a RET rearrangement. So I'm giving them osimertinib with selpercatinib. Any feedback? And I was like, no, that's awesome. That's exactly what I would have done back at Dana-Farber. Yeah. So in fact, Ross, I just saw a patient, an older gentleman with PD-1 low lung cancer. And I was debating, should I give immunotherapy first line or chemoimmunotherapy first line, which is a debate that I think many clinicians struggle with in first line non-small cell lung cancer. And I sent a liquid biopsy and monitored him on immunotherapy single agent. I was able to de-escalate by using ctDNA monitoring, which is exactly the research that I was studying in my R01 back at Dana-Farber.
I know that was your R01 that you had to leave behind to join Foundation Medicine. It's come full circle.
And now I get to do it. So I think there's a potential to do really high quality care in huge diversity of settings. But also I think I identify gaps that I wish we could work on, right? Like an unfortunate proportion of my patients present in the hospital, which means that they have symptoms for such a period of time that they present, I think, maybe later than they could. And so how can we have visibility into cancer patients who end up presenting late? And what tools can we use to find them earlier? Now, I don't think that is screening a ctDNA in unaffected individuals necessarily. I think there are other diagnostic tools we can develop to help patients with cancer symptoms be identified and shorten their diagnostic odyssey. And I think probably my patients here at BMC have longer diagnostic odysseys than maybe some other patients who have a higher healthcare literacy. And so, you know, I see the dilemmas that get in the way of high quality care. And I also get to think still about how can I be a part of fixing those.
Wow. One of the things I tell all of my trainees is if you put in the work for a paper, you should always get it published. And I have one exception to that rule. I have a manuscript which has been sitting on my desk for 2 years, which I haven't been able to publish. But it actually shows that something like 30% of patients with small cell lung cancer present through the emergency room. And presenting through the emergency room is an adverse survival factor, even if you adjust for everything else. And so, because it's really a surrogate for socioeconomic status, support system, and everything else. And so I do feel there's the potential to flag these people as high risk in more than just their biology.
Because our cancer therapies are so much better than they used to be. And so when we miss the opportunity to give these therapies to a cancer patient because of late presentation, I feel like we're missing on a tremendous opportunity for impact. And so, yes, I'm dissatisfied by late presentation like that. And I like to think about what solutions there might be out there.
So you spent 2.5 years at Foundation and you were three and a half. I'm sorry, I was doing the math wrong. And
you were, as you always are, you know, this exciting, invigorating force of nature. It was always a thrill to see you. But then you moved from the diagnostic, I think you already name-dropped them, to Loxo-Lilly, to a true pharmaceutical drug development role. And honestly, I was excited because I got to see more of you. But what was the trigger for that?
I was always a researcher who thought about therapy development and diagnostic development. Those were two sides of me in my academic days. I picked one side of it. I think I missed out a little bit on actually hands-on designing trials and getting new medicines in patients. And so it was a part of me that I wasn't cultivating. It was incredibly satisfying to work at Foundation Medicine. I really enjoyed the teamwork of industry and having your eyes set on the same goal and all working together to get there. But I guess I felt like I stopped learning or I stopped growing in the way I wanted to. And by taking some time in drug development, I could grow in this other way and learn about drug development from the industry side. And it was wonderful. I mean, Lilly is an amazing place. They are being super creative in how they're implementing clinical trials. I really appreciated a commitment to trial enrollment. This idea that, you know, we have a trial that we think has something precious, a new medicine. And you, Ross, have something else precious, access to cancer patients. Why can't we meet up in a more efficient way and help get our therapies to your patients? And that process of like finding a site for your trial and getting your trial enrolled, it could take a year or more to get a site on board, paperwork and budgeting. It just feels so oppositional. If only we could really just team up together, get the patients, get the trial, make it happen. There's got to be a way to do this faster. And that was a really refreshing approach to, again, approaching drug development with urgency. Where can we shorten timelines and get these medicines into patients even faster? Lilly had a fantastic commitment to that.
Yeah, I really loved that. I, as you may know, you know, Harvard didn't need to join because they were so big and fancy, but I run an academic consortium called Atomic. And one of the things I get to see is the opening times for all of these 14 or 15 academic sites. And it's all based on, so you come to me with your trial and you say, I think we should pay your institution $15,000 per patient enrolled. And then my institution will go, what about 16? And you go, oh, blah, 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 blah. And then I open in 6 weeks. I'll have another institution that will go, what about 120,000? And then you argue for 12 months and you settle at, you know, 119, and you just wasted a year. And the trouble is the academics don't even know that's going on because it's all these other people with their own incentives of saying, well, I get paid more if I negotiate the budget down. And there has to be a bigger picture of like putting the patient and the research cause at the center of it and not just, you know, my own personal, you know, cog in the wheels metric of success.
And that, of course, must be a symptom of funding insecurity at institutions. Like, you know, I understand there are super complex motivations to all of those negotiations. And all I aspire to is that feeling of we're in this together. And thinking back to my time in academia, it did feel oppositional. And now having spent time on the drug development side, it doesn't need to be opposition. We really are trying to get to the same thing. We want to give great new therapies to patients and do it safely and effectively. But I think there's change happening and more institutions are seeing opportunities to be efficient. And those that can do it, those that can find efficiencies in getting trials open, their patients are accessing cancer therapies even sooner and are able to enroll even better. And so it's exciting to see change in a number of institutions to try to be more catalytic in how they can get trials to succeed.
Let's touch on oppositional in a slightly different way. So one of the things, as we were talking about, you know, careerism, is I felt during my time in industry that you moved from a certain selfishness in terms of achievements in academia, you know, getting the credit for things, moving things forward, but really, you know, you were the captain and the crew and everything on the ship, to an industry that was much more of a team spirit. And I certainly have seen this in you. I've seen you go from, you know, I'm Jeff and I represent Jeff and look how amazing I am, and you still are amazing, but to really pulling that team forward and leading by inspiration. So that's my expression from the outside, but tell me whether that's an accurate view of how your journey has been.
I mean, I enjoy the fresh incentives of industry. There are some complicated incentives in industry as well, right? There are financial incentives that are messy, but certainly I appreciate that we're all swimming together in the same direction. But of course, you can have that in academia also, right? There are fantastic team leaders all around academia, but there are also ways in which academia tells you to focus back on yourself. And it's just a risk, right? If you find that in yourself. And yeah, I think I saw myself doing that some towards the end of my time in academia. It's a risk where you're maybe get focused on the wrong thing. I would go back to academia in a second. And I mean, I certainly hope someday I can do that after I've completed my journey in industry or maybe along the way to whatever next I'm going to do. It's a wonderful place to educate and gosh, to give great cancer care. Like I certainly miss it. And oh, I miss my patients, Ross. I really miss my patients.
But if you went back, and you know, we never know what's happened. We have colleagues who have gone in and out of industry. But if you came back, would you be the same person?
No, I think you're right. I would have a fresh perspective on how to lead a team towards a shared goal. And I hope I would be able to do with a more balanced and well-rounded perspective on what good looks like. But we can all do that ourselves. It's just we need to set our goals. And unfortunately, academia sometimes can create a misaligned goal structure that, any young investigator needs to be aware of as they embark upon this path. My advice is, whatever institution you're at, make yourself part of the fabric of that place. You'll find that institutional citizenship that makes you see how you fit into the whole. And I look back fondly on those things I did at Dana-Farber, the grant writing course that I started. Right? Make sure that each of us feel like we're part of the fabric of that place, or else you risk feeling floating outside of the fabric of that place. I think it's very doable. You don't need to go to industry to learn these things. But maybe it's helped me in how I think about leadership and really setting your sights on the right goals, right? Prioritization. How can I have a clean sense of what I'm up to here and say yes to the right things and say no to the right things so I can get to the place where I achieve my ambitions? Industry tries to be very disciplined about those things. And I think academia, we sometimes are less disciplined and it makes us spread thin and perhaps a little bit burnt out.
I mean, Your latest part of your odyssey is jumping after a relatively short period of time to this job because you felt the job really had your name on it at Blossom Hill to being the CMO. And you are now in the position for a relatively small company to literally model what clinical development should be and how the clinicians and the scientists should work together. So how are you doing that? And how long have you been there? Like 6 weeks or something?
Yeah, I started beginning of this year. The opportunity I just couldn't say no to. Our founder, Jean Quees, a chemist, maybe you know, she designed lorlatinib and basically has designed this novel macrocyclic scaffold to inhibit EGFR in a whole way that's never been done before. So it's a whole new kind of chemical structure for EGFR inhibition. And I just found that irresistible. This molecule targets EGFR in its active conformation. So the conformation where mutant EGFR sits and therefore is selective for mutations and doesn't fit wild type EGFR. So it doesn't have the toxicities. And remarkably, this molecule appears to work against all the different EGFR mutations, including the resistance mutations. And I was like, oh, what an opportunity. Ross, I don't know, 5+ years back, I wrote a Nature Medicine paper about C797S, this new kind of resistance mutation in EGFR, and to be able to cultivate this molecule, this medicine that can overcome this resistance feels really special. I think for right now, I focused on great new medicines that I really want to get into patients. Right, this is one of a few different macrocyclic molecules that we're working on, and it's exciting to bring a really new medicine into patients. Am I going to get to sort of craft what clinical development looks like? I mean, you have to have a slightly more realistic ambitions at a small company, right? You know, we have very clear priorities and there's less of us to make it happen. I think working at a large pharma
you know, it'll all just happen and people will kind of bring you along on the journey. They'll tell you next you do this and you do your part. And it's a little less anxious. It's certainly at a smaller company. It's a little more frantic, right? But we know what we got to get done and the opportunity feels so palpable. But I really love being involved in a whole new medicine and the potential to treat this disease, EGFR mutant lung cancer, in a whole new way. It feels very special and a burden that I can't wait to try to deliver.
And how big is the clinical team so far? Am I looking at the clinical team?
The whole company is 40-50 individuals right now. We're growing. We have two clinical teams for two clinical programs. And we have development physicians. We have operations experts. And we have translation. All of the functions in development that are necessary, regulatory, et cetera. But like a function at a small company might be one or two people instead of 50 or 100 people, right? Which also means that, you know, you lean in and you get your hands dirty and you do it. And so certainly we as academics learn to just do it ourselves. And then I think when you're at a big organization, you're more likely to delegate that. And when you're at a smaller company, you just roll up your sleeves and get started. So it's very rewarding in that way.
Okay, I do have to ask one either nerdy or stupid or both question, which is, if this drug only works on the active form of the EGFR, aren't the side effects in skin and gut from the normal form of the EGFR entering an active state sometimes? So I still don't understand how you'd avoid the side effects.
It's a steady state where the protein shifts back and forth. It's just that the protein in human cancers, sits in the active conformation most of the time. And in healthy tissues, it sits in the wild type conformation, the inactive conformation, most of the time. And so the likelihood that the molecule is going to potently inhibit, it's non-covalent. So it's just built to really tightly link in to that active conformation when it's mutated and activated, like lorlatinib does, right? Lorlatinib, it was the original macrocyclic small molecule that has such a tight and precise and selective grip on ALK that it can lead to these remarkable durations of benefit. If you want to disrupt lorlatinib from binding ALK, you need not one, but often multiple different mutations to push it off because the binding is that tight. And so it's designed to offer that tight binding to the active conformation, but a minimal binding to the inactive conformation such that it will be released from a wild type protein, but will potently bind to a mutant protein.
Okay. All right.
Well, this is the science, but you know, the clinical trial's enrolling and we have to prove that opportunity through treating patients.
It's like that bit from Jerry Maguire, show me the clinical data.
And that's exactly my job.
All right, Jeff, you remain as buoyant and optimistic as ever. You've just started the new job. It seems a little premature to say, what are you hoping is going to happen in the next 5 years? But, you know, maybe you like personally and professionally. How old are the kids now?
The kids are 10, 8, 6, and 3. Still pretty young.
Yep.
I am blessed, you know, to largely work from home outside of Boston, though we are going to be having an office here in Boston. And so I am glad to be able to see my kids. But you know, travel is part of this business and it is part of making the impact. And so my goal is to be home when I can, to be with my family that I love and be out there taking care of cancer patients when I need to be to achieve the impact that I think we can do. But fundamentally, I'm just trying to keep learning, Ross. Like, this is an amazing environment. It's super evolving. It feels so different today than 5 years ago. And how different could it be 5 years from now? And so it's fun to be in a space that's shifting that quickly. So it keeps me on my toes, keeps me learning, and keeps me thinking about how I can make a difference today and tomorrow.
I love it. Jeff, thanks so much for sharing all of your insights and passion with us.
Thank you, Ross, for having me.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with me, Ross Kamage. Rate us and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, or follow us at DR Kamage on X for additional commentary.